From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're going to try and find the right balance in discussing the private health condition of religious leaders who also lead public lives. For a few years now, there have been unconfirmed rumors that LDS Church President Thomas S. Monson is suffering from some form of dementia. We've put the question to the church itself. They didn't answer directly, saying President Monson has always been private about his health, but they did concede he was naturally feeling the effects of advancing age. He's 87. And Monson isn't the only high-ranking leader feeling those effects, which makes sense given the average age of the governing body of the church is 80. It's the oldest in history. Today in the program, we're exploring the effect of mortal afflictions on the leaders of the LDS Church and what it reveals about the system of succession and the way members see their prophets. Join us after the news.
Hi, this is Elaine Clark, one of the producers of Radio West. Our free podcasts are made possible by KUER's generous listeners. If you're a fan, we invite you to put $10 in our tip jar. Text KUER to 85944 to make that donation. Thank you.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. There's been speculation and rumors about the health of LDS Church President Thomas S. Monson for a number of years now. And it does seem Monson's public duties have been somewhat limited. He hasn't conducted the church's general conference, a traditional duty the president shares with other members of the first presidency, since 2011. But that doesn't really prove much of anything. The most conspicuous illustration that President Monson may be feeling the effects of advancing age, as a church statement put it, was the fact that he did not participate in the recent meeting between President Obama and LDS leadership when Mr. Obama was in Utah earlier this month. An LDS church spokesman explained Monson wasn't there because of the need to, quote, preserve his strength for the upcoming general conference. President Monson is 87 years old. And of course, he's going to be slowing down. There isn't anything scandalous about that. But the speculation is actually quite specific, that Monson is suffering from some form of dementia, perhaps Alzheimer's disease. Now, this is a sensitive issue for obvious reasons, and it was difficult getting people to talk about it on the record. Mostly, of course, were there concerns about recklessly guessing on such a private matter. But most did agree there was some value in a broader discussion about what age and health means for a church that believes it is led by a prophet who speaks for God, but who is also mortal and can be afflicted by illness. The questions about Monson's health come with the news this month that two other members of the LDS Church's governing quorum of the 12 are suffering from serious ailments, cancer in one case. Also, there was a report in the Salt Lake Tribune that noted the average age of the 15 men who govern Mormon affairs is 80. It's never been older. And it makes sense if you think about the progress of medicine and health, but it also raises questions about public dimensions in a private health matter. So today in the program, we're going to explore some of these questions. First, we should say that we contacted the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints about this issue, and we asked them three specific questions. What was the health condition of President Monson? Did he, in fact, suffer from some form of dementia like Alzheimer's disease? And we asked if the church would consider conferring emeritus status on the more elderly members of the first presidency or the Quorum of the Twelve, like it does for other general authorities in the church. To the matter of President Monson's health, a statement sent to us conceded that he and others in church leadership are, quote, feeling the effects of advancing age. But the statement didn't directly answer the question about the particulars. It said this: President Monson has always been private about his health. It also pointed out that Monson spoke publicly at General Conference earlier this month, that he comes to the office every day, he attends all First Presidency and committee meetings, and not only that, but he leads the discussion and makes decisions. The statement also said the workload of the First Presidency is, quote, up to date. A church representative attached to the statement other talks by church leaders over the years to explain how the system of church governance works in the context of ailing leadership, and this is information we'll use as a basis for part of the conversation today. As to the question of emeritus status, the church did provide a very direct answer to that one, and it was pretty unequivocal. Here's what the representative told us in an email. Emeritus status is not a consideration for the First Presidency and Quorum of the Twelve who serve for life. Now, We should also acknowledge the delicacy of a matter like this one. And in this sense, we're actually grateful the church responded at all. In the email, the representative hoped we would handle the subject with sensitivity and respect, and we intend to do just that. So you can join us today with phone calls or emails, but I should say we're going to be really careful about how we screen calls and emails on this one to maintain that level of respect. Our number, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Joining us today in the program, first, Richard Bushman, who is an historian and professor emeritus at Columbia University. An active Latter-day Saint, wrote a very influential biography of Mormon founder Joseph Smith called Rough Stone Rolling. Professor Bushman is joining us from community radio station WCUW in Worcester, Massachusetts. And Richard Bushman, welcome back. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks.
Gregory Prince is an independent historian, also an active Latter-day Saint, co-wrote a book that explores the presidency of David O. McKay and how it shaped the LDS Church in the 20th century. It's called David O. McKay and the Rise of Modern Mormonism. He's joining us from a studio in Bethesda, Maryland. And Gregory Prince, welcome to you.
Thanks.
Well, I wanted to begin with sort of get the issue of whether this is a taboo subject or should be a taboo subject to talk about. Richard Bushman, is this, I'm sure you acknowledge the delicacy and getting beyond the particulars of one particular person. Is this a taboo? Should it be a taboo?
I don't feel like it's a taboo. I don't think any Latter-day Saints I know are hesitant about discussing President Monson's health. They're greatly interested in his well-being just because he's such an important figure in the church and in their own personal lives. I'm not sure that most Latter-day Saints feel that it's a tough issue at all, so far as I can tell.
Gregory Prince, what do you think?
I agree with Richard. On the one hand, you certainly want to respect the privacy of the individual, and I appreciate that tone has already been set for this broadcast. On the other hand, there have been times, notably with President Spencer Kimball, where the family and the church were quite forthcoming about serious health issues that he faced, including a subdural hematoma.
Yeah. Which I think we'll get back to this, actually. So how much of this can be directed by the family and how much can be directed or should be directed by the church itself? But let's come back to that. Richard Bushman, does the public have a right to know this? I mean, you've pointed out this is a church position. It's not a public elected office or anything like that. I mean, they deserve a measure of privacy, but they also play a public role.
Yes. I'm not sure you use the word right to know it. That's a political word.
Sure.
And I think it would have some bearing in a democracy where the people ultimately are responsible for the government and should have a say. The church isn't organized that way. Mm-hmm. And I think the church leaders may or may not wish to share information with them, but I'm not sure that that church members should say it's necessary for their well-being or for the well-being of the church that this information be made public.
Gregory Prince, what about you on that issue?
Well, I think in the LDS Church, we've got an interesting situation that very few other churches have. If you look at the name of the Church of Latter-day Saints, it's actually very descriptive in the sense that this is a church of the people, that there is no priestly class here. So you don't have the division between laity and clergy that you would see in other traditions. And what that means is that the collective voice of the church really can resound, and I think should resound, even though, as Richard says, we are not a voting democracy.
What did you make of the statement that the church offered to us, wanting obviously to keep it private, but reassuring us, and I guess by extension other people, that he's still very active? I mean, what did you make about, and how delicate is it, do you think, for the church? And how do you think they're kind of thinking about what they can say, what they should say, what the effect of it might be?
If you look at the actual governance of the church over many decades, it's been fairly constant, even when you've had a president who has been incapacitated for lengthy periods of time. Either counselors in the first presidency or the Quorum of the Twelve acting as a group carry on the affairs of state almost seamlessly.
Richard Bushman?
Well, I agree with Greg that it's an unusual organization in that the continuity of leadership is so sustained because the charismatic gifts, the gift of revelation, is so widely distributed. When, you know, this problem is not at all new in the church. We had President McKay was not functioning very well at the end of his life, nor was President Benson. And for years, President Hinckley, we knew, was sort of the governing hand on the tiller all that time. And it proceeded without a hitch, so far as I could tell. People were quite confident that President Hinckley could do the job because there were no unique powers held by the president of the church. He was the designated spokesman, but he was not the only recipient of revelation. So with that confidence that revelation is widely shared, when a counselor or the first presidency takes over, things move along quite smoothly.
So that I guess it does raise the question of what the Mormon rank and file believe about their about the one prophet. Now, we should point out, and I think some people may know this, others may not, that Mormons see the leaders in the first presidency and the Quorum of the Twelve all as so-called prophets, seers, and revelators. They all have certain keys to these particular functions. But there is one president, of course, one designated president referred to often, you know, from the podium and in church as the prophet. So what do Mormons believe about the prophet in the sense that seeing them clearly as mortal, of course, you know, subject to the afflictions of mortality, but is there a difference between a physical ailment and what maybe in this case, a mental one, the effects of a mental capacity, and function? Does that complicate things, I guess? Gregory Prince?
Oh, I think it can complicate things. At the same time that I said that things can go on seamlessly in terms of the governance of the church, it's not the same if you don't have a highly functioning president. When we were working on the McKay biography, my co-author Bob Wright interviewed President Hinckley and raised this issue with him. This was in 1996. Hinckley's response, I think, is very appropriate for our discussion here. He said, "I was counselor to President Kimball. Then he became sick. Then President Tanner died. Then President Romney became indisposed, and I was alone. I was then second counselor. I tried to be very, very careful in those circumstances. The policies were well established. We didn't need a lot of new things. The church was getting along well, doing well. I resisted efforts to move on some things where I was urged at times to do so. I did not want to get ahead of the president." And so clearly what he's saying there is you can do most of the job if you don't have a functioning president of the church, but you can't do all of the job. And for a church that is as large and as high profile as this one, not to have a single prophetic voice out in front is not the way we'd like to have it. We enjoy having that prophetic voice in the person of one individual, even though we are sustaining 15 individuals as having that.
Can a person without all their mental faculties theoretically receive revelation? I mean, is that problematic? And would that be problematic, do you think, for members of the church? Richard Bushman?
Well, it's hard to say, you know, just what is the form of the limitations on any person's capacities at a point like that. I think you can imagine kind of a scary scenario where someone is incompetent and yet insists on asserting authority. Mm-hmm. And going off the rail in some way. But I think what has been made clear, and it's been made clear in church's statements, is that there are all sorts of checks and balances in the church. That, even though the prophet is the prophet, He is surrounded by counselors. He's surrounded by the Quorum of the Twelve, which always has a voice in the most important decisions. So the chances of a real error being made, I think, are very slight. I think what Greg is referring to is there some inhibition, some initiatives that President Hinckley was unwilling to take, because he was not in the prophet's chair. And I know I've heard him say similar things. I think he was very sensitive about the fact that the prophet himself was not fully in command of things. But so far as I can tell, it did not reduce the dynamism of the church. It just kept rolling along. You know, you wouldn't say that the church was struggling or faltered during that period. It kept going very well. Perhaps some projects had to be postponed, but that was not really detrimental.
What do you think about, I mean, this is a very, there are a lot of issues that the church, fairly public issues that the LDS Church has been dealing with over the past couple of certainly months and years, certainly this question about this anti-discrimination law that they were behind, obviously their involvement in the same-sex marriage debate. There are questions, obviously, that come up during legislative sessions here in Utah anyway, related to certain matters of public policy, those kinds of things. And I'm wondering what you think, how difficult this is. You often hear talk of a power vacuum. If you don't have a particular leader who's, if because of ailment they're not entirely engaged or not engaged in the way someone else might have been, does it change the way is the structure set up to be able to deal with issues like that and issues of disciplining people? Obviously, there have been some very high-profile excommunications over the last year or so. Not to mention those other things. So this question of a power vacuum, Gregory Prince, can you talk to that?
I think that you're raising the LGBT issue is an appropriate issue to focus on. If you have a very strong leader such as President Hinckley, who maintained an amazing, I think, degree of mental acuity right up until 2 or 3 days before his death, you tend to have a much more even message that would come out. What we have seen in the last couple of years, even just looking at General Conference addresses, is that there seems to be a mixed message coming out on LGBT issues. Now, you have to extrapolate backwards and say, how could that be? But I think that one way that you wind up with that is if you don't have that single central authority, who sets the tone for everybody with no questions asked.
Richard Bushman, you agree with that?
Well, I think it's true, but that if you have a very strong hand managing things, that where there is controversy, they can go in and kind of settle matters. And you can picture that happen. But it's also a temptation for people who want the strong voice to speak out in a certain tone, to imagine that if only someone else had been in charge, it would have gone the way I wanted it to go. So I think we have to be a little careful about saying the real problem was a power vacuum when it might have been just that the church authorities disagreed with our point of view.
Well, you hear that a lot. I mean, you all throughout the so-called Mormon bloggernacle, you hear these references that Thomas S. Monson, or rather Gordon B. Hinckley, wouldn't have handed Prop 8 like Thomas S. Monson did. But I'm not sure how you can nail that down. I mean, is that what you mean, Richard Bushman? Kind of, it's speculation. It's academic.
Yeah, I think, you know, I'm an early American historian, and all the colonists felt that if only the king could knew our problems, he would take care of us.
Right.
And of course, when finally the king did intervene, he said to blast him out of the water. So it's a temptation to imagine a benevolent leader who would always be on your side.
Let's take a call. 801-585-WEST is the number to join the conversation. Craig is with us in Provo. Craig, welcome.
Hi, Doug. How are you doing today?
Fine, thanks.
Good. Thank you for taking my call. The question that I have is, do we really know how much control of the church the prophet really has? Do we know if he has the final say and the stamp of approval on everything that passes policies or doctrine, or how much, if anything goes on that he isn't, fully involved in?
Well, Gregory Prince, you want to speak to that? I guess, how do you know,
sure.
I suppose?
Sure. I think it's instructive to look historically in answering that question. Until the death of President McKay in 1970, to use, I think, an appropriate analogy, the church was a monarchy, in the sense that the president of the church was both head of state and head of government. After President McKay's death, largely through the efforts of Harold B. Lee, who first was a counselor in the presidency and then became the church president, we moved in the direction of a constitutional monarchy, which meant that more and more of the things that used to be done at the level of the first presidency were shifted over to the Quorum of the Twelve. I interviewed a former chief financial officer of the church, and he said that back in the late 60s, he saw an organizational chart that was essentially flat, that nearly two dozen church departments and agencies all reported directly to the first presidency, and the Quorum of the Twelve were largely staff. That's changed enormously, so that now you have the president of the church largely, again using the analogy, acting as the head of state, whereas the president of the Quorum of the Twelve is the prime minister. He's the head of government. And so a lot of the day-to-day functioning of the church would be resolved at the level of the president of the Quorum of the Twelve rather than going into the first presidency.
So that's from your perspective, that was a fairly healthy transition, that move.
I think it was a healthy transition and also a very dramatic transition.
Richard Bushman, that seems very American, does it not? That kind of applying those kinds of checks and balances to the governance of a church?
Yes, or perhaps even more British, that the monarch doesn't dare do things that the parliament would disagree with. And what we have to keep in mind is how powerfully these men are committed to the idea of consensus. They don't want someone just running freely, just taking the church wherever they want. There's always a sense we have to agree on these things, and that at times paralyzes the church. It can't act. Mm-hmm. But it also is an assurance that there really is a lot of backing for every decision when it came through. So far as we can tell, President Kimball was very careful to seek out the opinion of brethren around the idea of giving blacks the priesthood. So, as Greg says, this is a check on power, but is also a source of immense strength, that when things are done, you really have support through all the higher levels of the church.
Richard Bushman is with us, the author of Joseph Smith, Rough Stone Rolling. Gregory Prince with us, too, co-author of David O. McKay and the Rise of Modern Mormonism. We invite you to join the conversation. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We need to take a break, and we'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we've been talking about the effect of age and illness on the leadership of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. We're interested in the effect of all of this on the church itself, but also on the matters of governance, what it reveals about the systems of the church, and what it means for succession as well. Richard Bushman is with us, the author of Joseph Smith, Rough Stone Rolling, an historian, professor emeritus at Columbia University. Gregory Prince, an independent historian, forgive me, is also with us, co-author of the book David O. McKay and the Rise of Modern Mormonism. 801-585-WEST is the number, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Richard Bushman, how did it start, the idea of succession, for example? What was it like in the early days? Did Joseph Smith have a very particular idea of how the presidency should be passed along?
It wasn't entirely clear. There were a number of clues given. One was that there would be succession through his son, which is the direction that the reorganized church took. And the other was that all the keys and powers were invested in a set of quorums, the Council of the First Presidency, the Council of the Twelve, and there's a whole series of them going down to 70 and the joint high councils of the church. So there was a sense that governance was widespread, and when one group was out of non-functioning, another one could take over. And when the issue came up in 1844, after Joseph Smith's death, the idea of the council, that the Council of the Twelve held the keys, was the one that prevailed with the group that eventually came to Utah. There were others who disagree. There are many contests for the presidency of the church, but that's that tradition of a council holding keys is the one that's carried on down to this day. And of course, for many years, the council, not many years, but for 3 years, the Council of the Twelve ran the church with Brigham Young at the head before he was called and sustained as president.
The email, so I guess the question then is, the way it works now, help me understand this, Professor Bushman and Gregory Prinz, I want to hear from you on this as well. So are they set in stone at this point? I mean, you often hear, certainly at the times when church leaders die, presidents die, like Gordon B. Hinckley, you hear from the church that this is how it works. It's a seniority, at least that's the tradition. And I don't think they've wavered, at least not in modern Mormonism, from the tradition which says whoever's the most high-ranking official then ultimately becomes president of the church. But does it necessarily have to be that way? I mean, is it a tradition or is it a doctrine?
It's a very strongly entrenched tradition. In the Mormon Church, I don't think anything is really set in stone. Because of our doctrine of revelation, there could be all sorts of departures if the need arose.
Gregory Prinz?
We are a tradition that feels very strongly about the way things are until they change, and then we feel very strongly about the way they become. Richard rightly said that there were multiple methods of succession that Joseph Smith had hinted at, though he never was really firm, hence you had all of these schismatic movements after his death.
Right.
Even after the church that went to Utah went with the apostolic succession, there were some fundamental changes made within that type of succession. For instance, when the Quorum of the Twelve was first constituted in 1835, seniority was on the basis of age. That worked okay until you had replacements of apostles, and then the question became, so if the new guy in the quorum is older than the other 11 guys, does he become senior?
Right.
And that was a consequential question because Lyman White was a replacement in the Quorum of the Twelve, and he was the oldest of the 12 as then constituted. Had they not changed and said, no, it's the senior apostle in terms of tenure,
right,
Lyman White would have been president of the church. Now, they changed it again near the end of Brigham Young's life. It was no secret that he and Orson Pratt had sparred publicly on doctrinal issues. Brigham said, we are now going to count the duration of tenure being the most recent time you were in the Quorum of the Twelve, because both Orson Pratt and Orson Hyde had been expelled from the Twelve, albeit for a fairly brief period of time. Had Brigham Young not restarted the clock, both of those men would have become the president of the church. And then again, at the turn of the 20th century, Brigham Young Jr. was the senior apostle in terms of how long had he been ordained to that office. But he had been ordained by his father at a time when there wasn't a vacancy in the Quorum of the Twelve. And so once again, the rules were changed, and it became the clock starts when you go into the Quorum of the Twelve, not when you are ordained an apostle.
So they keep,
and so
they keep
there are four men who would have become president had the rules not been changed.
Well, then, but then the rules keep changing, or they have been changed. But as Richard Bushman said, it's a really entrenched tradition now. And as he also mentioned, nothing is set in stone. But is it pretty close to that? I mean, do you see them budging at this point on that, on the tradition where they are now?
Well, you can't speculate with any certainty on an issue of that importance looking forward. But if you look backwards at other issues and then move forward with them, you can see that we were very, very unambiguous in statements that senior church members all the way up to the first presidency made about blacks and priesthood. And yet, in 1978, the world changed for Mormons. And so, if you look at the certitude of the rhetoric there and move forward, I think you always have to put an asterisk on the end of any of these statements and say, if you are a prophetic tradition, does not prophecy connote change? And we have that tension within the church that, on the one hand, we would all vote in favor of the principle of continuing revelation. We feel that it's bedrock. On the other hand, if you ask the same congregation, how comfortable are you with substantive change, you'd probably get a lot of nervous looks. That's where the tension is.
Elder Russell Nelson of the Quorum of the Twelve gave this talk last October that touched on this issue, and he said this. He said, man's ways remove people from offices of business when they grow old or become disabled, but man's ways are not and never will be the Lord's ways. Now, what does that tell you about the way the current leaders are thinking about whether there should be any idea of emeritus status or how they're going to deal with this idea that this is the hand of God and we can't really mess with it? Richard Bushman?
It shows that it's a question that has to be contemplated. Should we stick with a method that is quite contrary to any forms of succession in business corporations or not so much in governments? Kings tend to hold on a long time in monarchies, but in most sort of bureaucratic organizations today. But what he's saying is we're going to stick with the old way. This is what we've learned. This is what has been confirmed by our practice, and we feel it's God's ways. And we're going to stick with it, even if it doesn't make sense from some points of view.
801-585-WEST is the number to join the conversation. Back to the phones. Gail is with us in Pleasant Grove. Gail, welcome.
Thank you. I just have one simple thing to say, and I'm grateful that you brought it around to the highest authority, of course, which is the Lord Jesus Christ, because I have absolute faith in my leaders 100%, and my faith rests in my Savior as well, mostly. But I'm confident that He is the one in control. Our leaders obey and listen to Him and lead the church in the direction it needs to go, and I feel like the Lord uses the talents each leader has to make the changes necessary to put the men in office that are necessary and whatever other changes or direction the church needs to go, the Lord's in control.
You hear that a lot. I mean, Gordon B. Hinckley gave a talk, I think, in the mid-90s, talking about dealing with this. This was clearly on people's minds. I think there had been President Benson, I think, at the time was ill, and I think people knew it. And he wanted to reiterate this point that God was at the helm, was the point that he made. It may transition into, here's a question from Scott, and I wanted to, Richard Bushman, get you and Gregory Prince on this one. He asks, it's my understanding that the prophet of the LDS Church directly communicates with God, or is at least inspired by God to lead the church. So I respectfully ask, if the mind of the prophet is compromised, how does that affect this divine connection? And can that connection be fully trusted anymore? Richard Bushman, you want to take that?
Well, I think we've really dealt with that issue that, you know, if he's on his deathbed and hardly conscious, we don't expect the Lord to send revelation to him. And if his mind loses some of its acuity as time goes by, he might not be able to speak as clearly for the Lord. But the assurance is that through the whole system, through the series of councils, through the inspiration that's given to every one of the prophets, seers, and revelators, that the course of the church will go on. It will follow the right path. So much as we trust and love our prophet, and heavens knows that's true among Mormons, There isn't a sense that he is the sole spokesman. That's the not the only channel to heaven. Mm, mm. And that, of course, becomes very critical in a case of serious illness.
Right. Here's something from Rob, who writes, "It seems that because members of the LDS Church are asked to make major life decisions based on the Council of Church Leadership, they have a right to know if those leaders are suffering from psychological or neurological conditions." Jim writes this, "In the bylaws, you can vote out the president of the church," he says. "Is there anything that would prevent the president from being removed or from stepping down?" I'm going to actually ask you to hold off on that, Gregory Prince and Richard Bushman, because I want to get to that question of emeritus status, whether that would be an option when we get back from a break. 801-585-WEST, the number, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take a break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, talking about the effect of age on the leadership of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints with Richard Bushman, author of the book Joseph Smith, Rough Stone Rolling, Gregory Prince with us, co-author of the book David O. McKay and the Rise of Modern Mormonism. 801-585-WEST, the number, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. So Jim sent that question I mentioned right before we went to the break about whether or not there's anything in the sort of bylaws that would prevent the president from stepping down or being removed. And I mentioned the email we received from a church representative about whether the church would depart from tradition and confer emeritus status on members of the governing first presidency and quorum of the 12. And we got a pretty straightforward answer. Emeritus status is not a consideration because they serve for life. So, Gregory Prince, is it an option? Sounds like it's not.
Well, again, I think we can get some direction by looking at history, and it's not too ancient history. In the mid-1960s, President McKay met with the seven members of the First Council of 70 and asked them to look seriously at that office historically in the current church and projecting into the future and to make recommendations. But he said, whatever your recommendations, they must be unanimous.
Why was he doing that? Because they were getting older and he was concerned about that issue?
I think he was just evaluating that office because it was a strange office in the sense that at a local level it functioned differently than the other local level priesthood offices, and that became awkward. So this gentleman said, we talked about emeritus in that first meeting, but we had two holdouts of the seven who said we were called for life. And he said it took another decade and three subsequent presidents before we reached unanimity on it. And then in President Kimball's administration, they instituted emeritus for the first quorum of 70, meaning when you reach the age of 70, and there have been a couple of exceptions, but not many, then you are placed on emeritus status. My follow-up question in this interview was, did you mention this to the 12 or to the first presidency?
Right.
And he said, that was above our pay grade, but we opened the door if they had wanted to walk through.
Yeah. Is it true that Hugh B. Brown, who was in the church's first presidency, volunteered to be an emeritus member of that body?
I interviewed his grandson, Ed Firmage, when I was working on the McKay book, after President Brown was released from the first presidency at the death of President McKay and went back into the Quorum of the Twelve. According to his grandson, yes, he volunteered to start a new precedent of becoming an emeritus apostle, but clearly that didn't happen.
Mm-hmm. Richard Bushman, I guess we can't say whether or not there's a consideration of something like that. I mean, strongly held tradition, those are the words you used earlier. Do you get any sense that this might be, this emeritus status might be an adjustment that even high-ranking, the 12 in the first presidency, may consider given this new reality?
I don't think there's any signs of it now, but I don't think it's totally out of the realm of possibility that in some time that would happen. You can imagine some president feeling that circumstances were such it was necessary. But there is an inhibition here, which is that there is this belief that the hand of the Lord is acting through the deaths of the leaders to select the next prophet.
Right.
And it's that sense that divine providence is somehow managing things through who survives and who does not that makes people reluctant to sort of second-guess God and step down before they're called home.
So we can't force the hand of God, basically, or shouldn't.
I think that something like that is in the background.
But it seems like that Mormonism also has an answer to that, in the sense that don't Mormons always talk about the fact that you have to deal with mortality, you have to deal with the realities here. God wants you to act. You can't just wait. I mean, is there a particularly Mormon unique approach to this that could get beyond that?
Oh, I think that's true. Mormons, you do take things in hand, but it's always considered a collaboration.
Right.
You know, you seek for inspiration, but you can't wait. You have to act. So it goes back and forth on that issue, and that will sort of keep it up in the air, I think, for some time. But for right now, I don't think the church is going to say or do anything that will undermine the current mode of succession.
Gregory Prince, you tell this story from former Utah Governor Calvin Rampton. This was in 1969, and the question had come up, and I guess it wasn't unlike what's going on today. I mean, President McKay was ailing. President Joseph Fielding Smith was almost 90 years old. He was next in line. And there was a question whether or not he was going to be the next president of the church. Do you know what story I'm talking about, or am I putting you on the spot?
No, I do know the story. It was at a dinner, and he was sitting next to Harold B. Lee, but he was also sitting next to Jesse Evans Smith, who was the wife of Joseph Fielding Smith. And he said, "It dawned on me that Lee wasn't talking to me, he was talking past me, and reassuring Jesse that he wasn't going to usurp the right of her husband to become the church president."
So he was saying at this dinner, he was basically saying, "We're going to follow tradition. The next president of the church won't be me. It will be Joseph Fielding Smith."
Yes. Doug, I'd like to return to an earlier question that you raised, because I think it is a crucial question, and that is, what is the nature of revelation? We throw that word around a lot. Is it an event, or is it a process? And from all of the historical research that I've done, I come somewhere in the middle, and I borrow the phrase that biologist Stephen Jay Gould used when talking about biological evolution. He called it punctuated equilibrium.
Right.
That generally revelation historically has been a process, and it's a process that sometimes may stretch out for decades that may be punctuated by a very dramatic event. This is what happened with the 1978 revelation. That process had begun at least as early as the early 1950s with David O. McKay, but he was never able to take it to the point where I think he wanted to, because he felt that he needed to receive a confirmation that he never got.
Hmm. Well, all that says now, as the modern Mormon church faces a lot of social change, what that means is members are going to have to be patient. Richard Bushman?
Patient about what?
Well, there's a question that comes from Ryan, who says, would emeritus status lead to more rapid change in the church, since there would be much younger people involved? And you do hear that from time to time, whether or not these leaders who came of age in the Eisenhower administration, whether they're out of touch in some way with social change, not just LGBT issues, but other issues that the church, you know, inevitably is dealing with. So I guess that's the question.
Sure, I think it's conceivable. In all societies, the young men tend to be impatient and the old men tend to be wise and slow to act. That's certainly true in Native American societies, and it may be true in the church to some extent. But I don't think we should underestimate the capacity of older men to make fairly dramatic decisions. I mean, we certainly have President Kimball as an example. You know, at the very end of his administration and his life, he makes this most drastic change of the 20th century, giving blacks the priesthood. So I don't ever think we should think that some kind of administrative change would change the entire cast of the church. Mm. It's not necessarily going to work that way.
Gregory Prince, I'm not sure if there are any direct parallels in the Catholic experience, but it is interesting, and it seems in some ways groundbreaking, that Pope Benedict stepped down from his office, became a Pope Emeritus. Is there any kind of significance to that, do you think, for the Mormon story?
I think that there are two examples, not just Roman Catholicism, that at least are worth looking at, because in both instances, as with the LDS Church, the leader of the church served until death. The Roman Catholicism was one where Pope Benedict made this astounding announcement, and you can see the effect that has had on Roman Catholicism worldwide. It's breathtaking. The other one was our cousins, the reorganized LDS Church that's now called the Community of Christ, where, again, the president served until death, but about three decades ago, Wallace Smith, the president, stood up in World Conference and said, 2 years from now, in our next World Conference, I will step down and my son will become president. Thereby, he ended the tradition within the Community of Christ of service until death. That doesn't say either that that's what the LDS Church should do or what it will do, but it says that other traditions that have had leaders until death don't always stick with that tradition.
There is a question you hear from time to time that seems to be a concern that there's a kind of extreme adulation going on within Mormonism. Some have referred to it as a kind of hero worship of church presidents and church general authorities. And I'm wondering if that, what you make of that question, which you hear from time to time, if that may be one of the reasons why you may get some resistance from the leaders to do an emeritus status sort of kind of proposal, or to maybe move aside, because it's a great job in the sense that you get this adulation, you get this kind of hero worship. Richard Bushman, is that a fair question?
I'm not sure it is a fair question, Doug. Certainly there's a lot of respect and love, and that must, the brethren are always thanking the members for their support and their prayers and so on. But I just can't believe that people are going to hang on to office just because they're so hungry for that kind of adulation. These are really tough jobs, huge headaches. We see only the tip of the iceberg of what they have to do. And especially when you get very old and your energy level begins to drop, to carry on in those positions is a huge burden. And I think in a way you could say it might work the other way around, that they would welcome the chance to take a rest and kind of rest on their laurels for a time.
Gregory Prince, if you could make a proposal for dealing with this, do you see a way forward that would work within the way the systems of the church are in place, the way that the church generally does this?
Well, it's not my call and my pay grade, certainly, but following up on the interview that I did before with the gentleman who was in the First Council of 70, they could walk through the same door and set whatever age range they wish to set, both for the Quorum of the Twelve and even for the President of the Church. What age, if any, you would want to set, that becomes debatable, but we feel very strongly that we do the way we do them because we do them that way until we do them differently. And so our history really not only allows but mandates that prophetic voice speak, and sometimes speak to make major changes rather than just maintaining the status quo indefinitely. It's their call.
Okay, so the final question then to you both, and it is above your pay grade, so you may not want to answer it, but I guess the question is, would it be good for the church in general to be a little bit more open about the health condition of President Monson, for example, or any leaders for that matter, to come right out? I mean, could it be a good thing, in fact, if in fact President Monson was suffering from some kind of dementia or something like that, to actually deal with it up front and reassure people and talk about it? Do you want to say anything at all about that? Richard Bushman, you first.
I was quite interested how much was mentioned about Elder Perry's and Elder Scott's recent illnesses.
Yeah.
It seemed to be a slight move in that direction of being more open, not because they wanted to breach their privacy, but just because they know members of the church are concerned about these brethren. I don't think they want to turn it into a matter of gossip and speculation, what's going to happen if, how is this debilitating the church? But I think it's will be a slightly more information coming forth about illness within the bounds of respect for these brethren.
Gregory Prince, less than a minute. Do you want to?
Yes, with Richard's biography of Joseph Smith and with mine of President McKay, we humanized two men without degrading them. And so, with the caveat that you want to respect the privacy of the individual and the family, my feeling is the more disclosure, the more information that the laity can have, I think the healthier the church becomes.
It's Gregory Prince, co-author, along with William Robert Wright, of David O. McKay and the Rise of Modern Mormonism. Gregory Prince, thanks for joining us today.
You're welcome.
And Professor Richard Bushman, Professor Emeritus at Columbia University, author of the book Joseph Smith, Rough Stone Rolling. Professor Bushman, thanks to you as well.
Thank you. Pleasure.
Radio West, a production of KUER News. Technical direction from Tim Slover. The program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.